Welcome to another exciting edition of Two Guys Talking.
War on Christmas edition.
Previously known as Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Robert Winters.
And I'm Patrick Barrett.
Right.
Aloha.
That's right. You know, the contradiction in terms. Aloha, Santa. Right. So anyway, this will be our last show of the calendar year. Judy's out this week. Next week is Christmas time, and then New Year's, and then we'll be back after the City Council.
Merry Christmas, Judy.
Yes, very much. So let's see. So what's to begin with? I said, one thing we'll see briefly, just to say here, because I've been seeing my name actually quoted in a few newspaper articles.
Ooh, you're famous.
In regard to what may likely be a resignation of a newly elected school committee member, Emily Dexter. All right. And I don't know for sure if that's actually going to happen. There seems to be some question about whether, you know, what the protocols would be, even if it were to happen. One of the things is people have been asking, well, if there should be a vacancy, how are vacancies handled? And at least in one account, maybe more, it was sort of misstated. Right. So how many
Surely
people
not.
Out there know how we fill a vacancy?
I read it on the Internet. It's absolutely true.
That's very good philosophy
thank
there.
You,
yeah. Anyway, I've heard in one account, some people believe, it should be the last person counted out. That's not true. Or it should be, the one I read was that you just look at the number one votes for the candidate who would be exiting, and you determine the replacement by doing a runoff election just from the number one votes. That's also not true.
I just assume the city manager had a wheel, he spun it.
They just call me up and I say, I pick this one. No, the way it works is, and this is actually not that complicated, is that you take the ballots who elected the councilor or school committee member.
Okay.
Right? And that doesn't necessarily mean the number one vote ballots.
What does that mean, the ballots that elected?
Well, you know, when you get elected, typically you get elected because you've reached quota.
Right.
Or you were just simply one of the last candidates standing. So in the case of Emily Dexter, she actually had more than enough votes to be elected in the first round. She then gave up some of those surplus ballots to other candidates, which mm-hmm. reduced her to a quota of ballots.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ballots who would determine her replacement. So there would actually be some of the number one ballots actually wouldn't even be factor in.
Okay.
Because they've already been given away to others. Now, if it was a different candidate who was not elected in the first count, they actually received a lot of ballots from other candidates along the way, which brought that candidate up to the winning threshold.
I just want to pause for a moment and just right. I'd say I'm confused, and I think that this is a terrible way to do anything. We need to change our voting system.
The voting system is designed to at least attempt to get proportional representation of various constituencies. I think it's a perfectly good argument to discuss whether it actually achieves that in
right.
this day and age, in this current climate. I don't know if it does.
I wasn't making a political statement. I just said you broke my brain with the description, so I don't have no idea.
Right. Well, it's as though you had a room full of people who are the ones who elected a candidate, and you said, mm-hmm. all right, he's gone or she's gone. Who do you want now? And then they would fight amongst themselves.
Oh, that makes sense.
See, but that's effectively what the algorithm tries to accomplish. But again, just to say, because this has happened in relatively recent years, not so much, well, I'll give you the one thing that's marginally parallel to the current situation, but even there it's not really, is that, you know, when Brian Murphy resigned from the city council to take a job with the state, and when Michael Sullivan resigned, because there was perceived conflicts with his other position as Middlesex County Clerk of Courts, they had to determine their replacement. And you took simply the ballots that were used to elect those two individuals, not their number one votes. It's the total universe of ballots that elected them.
The universe of ballots.
The universe of ballots.
Sounds like a terrible show on PBS.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Really? Yeah. But those ballots would then be used to determine the replacement. And if there's in the output files from the tabulation software from the election, just so people, because people have been calling me. Honestly, the people who were trying to run Emily Dexter out called me or contacted me and wanted to know who the replacement would be.
Well, you are the Wizard of Oz.
I am the great and powerful Oz. It is true. Right? So anyway, the the tabulation software actually produces a file called the Final Piles Report, which actually has, these are the votes that elected candidate so-and-so. These are the ones that elected so-and-so. Da-da-da-da-da. And then it just looks at those group and it says, let's run them off until we eliminate everybody, get to one. So it's very easy to run.
So right? What's the answer, Professor?
Well, the answer is that Emily Dexter would be replaced by David Weinstein, who would beat Alechi Cadetti by approximately 100 votes in the end, in the final count, right?
I like Alechi.
All right.
I don't know Mr. Weinstein, though.
Alechi? David Weinstein? What? David Weinstein's a decent guy. He was up at Cambridge Highlands on, was it South Normandy Street? Decent guy. Had a couple of nice kids. I've been to his house.
His kids, young kids in the school system? He's actually...
kids in the school system.
Great. Right.
Yeah, you guys got a lot in common, right? Right. Anyway, one of the things, I don't know if we actually have this. I'm going to screw this up if I actually start playing around with this this computer. But maybe not. I'm going to do that just because people were asking. And again, I'm trying not to get too nerdy here. Is that there is the various council people who would replace the 9 city councilors. You know, if Dennis Carlone were to leave, replaced by Craig Kelly, Mallon by Musgrave, McGovern by Musgrave, Nolan by Kelly, Siddiqui by Musgrave. You can see some of the slate dynamics in here, by the way. Simmons by Kelly, which I found quite interesting. Sabrina Wheeler would be replaced by Burhan Azim, which makes total sense. Tim Toomey by Craig Kelly and Quentin Zondervan by Nicola Williams.
So,
but more interesting on the school committee side, and this is really what, of course, if Monique Obama were to leave, she'd be replaced by Bernadette Dawson, Dexter by Weinstein, Fantini by Ruth Ryan Allen, Rojas Villarreal by Alechi Cadetti, Rachel Weinstein by David Weinstein. It's like
no relation.
No relation, just trading one Weinstein for another. And Aisha Williamson by Bernadette Dawson. So anyway, that's just based on running the tabulation software. It's exactly what the Election Commission will do, using exactly the same ballots, data, the exact same software, this actually have to come to that, which it likely will. And if it does, it's not even clear when it would happen or whatever, but they would have to schedule a meeting. And the way it works is you then have to send a certified letter to all the candidates alerting to them that they are now eligible to be a vacancy refill. One year it actually happened that Robert Hall Sr. was an eligible candidate to replace, Brian Murphy, or it could have been Michael Sullivan, but he had actually passed away in the interim. And I pointed that out. This is sort of dark humor, but I have to say it because it was kind of hysterical.
Dark school committee humor, my goodness.
Right, right. Ms. Spears was on this election commission at the time, Artis Spears, and she runs a funeral. She's a funeral director.
And she's a great neighbor.
Wonderful person.
Yeah.
And so it was pointed out, well, who are the candidates to remain? I said, you know, and they mentioned Robert Hall, and I said, well, but he recently passed away. And one of the election commissioners said, well, how do we know that? And Artis Spears, this was the most priceless moment in Cambridge, says, well, I know, I buried him.
Confirmation.
That's pretty wild. You know, I don't think you'll ever hear that one again, right?
No.
But the closest thing to that I could point out to a parallel, should this take place, is what happened when Tim Toomey was elected. When he was first elected to the school committee in 1985, in fact, he wasn't elected. He was, what happened is Joe Maynard was elected.
My God.
And after the election, but before the inauguration in January, Joe Maynard passed away. And then Timmy was contacted, you know, and quite shocked. And then the ballots that had elected Joe Maynard were then used to elect his replacement, which is Tim Toomey. And that's how Tim Toomey was first elected to the school committee. And 4 years later, he ran for city council, and he's been a city councilor ever since.
And that's how Tim Toomey saved Christmas.
That's right. That's right.
Tiny Tim.
Right. So anyway, enough of that stuff. By the way, I'll just mention here, I'm not going to show you all the charts and graphs here, but just playing with ballot data, you know, I did some things to see if you use the ballots to elect a mayor, you know, to elect one person out of the nine who were elected, who would it be? Answer, Sumbul Siddiqui, not Patrick Barrett. And the and if you were to elect the vice chair, who's, you know, the person who appoints the committees for the school committee, that person would be Emily Dexter, which I find somewhat ironic. But anyway, there's all the other ballot data analysis I did, which is just looking at if you counted somebody as having either not just a number one, but either a one or a two, or a one or two and a three, and you do measures of popularity. I compiled all of that stuff here, and I think it's quite interesting to see when you actually look at deeper preferences to see who's actually quite popular, even if they didn't top it off with the number of votes.
The thing that I like the most about looking at the data is seeing Sumbul like atop the entire thing. And like, I'm not even politically aligned with Sumbul, but she was dropped like a hot potato by so many groups for one vote in the courthouse, which was the right vote and the right thing to do.
I agree.
And everyone was like, well, you know, she doesn't have a chance. We don't have our endorsement. Right. Our revolution.
Right. they tried to shame her, but she came back as the strongest candidate in the field.
It. Absolutely crushed it.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, honestly, I don't know if she wants to be mayor, but I don't think she makes the best case, I think.
I think she'd be a great mayor.
So do I. You know, even if I disagree with some of the things politically, I just think in terms of disposition.
I disagree with everyone in this town politically. There's no one I agree with. They're all crazy.
I find myself more and more aligning with you politically in this regard.
I just nod my head, all right.
Yeah.
Trying to keep it breaking.
Anyway, so that was enough of the politics of that here. Mm-hmm. We did have a few things have been happening on the political front with the city council, who had their very last meeting of the year, of the term, last night.
Yeah.
Probably worth noting right off the top, it was the last meeting for both Jan Devereaux and Craig Kelly.
It was a heartfelt bon voyage, colleagues and embracing each other. No.
Well, I always think when I hear sort of fond memories and fond statements, some of them are thoroughly sincere. But, you know, some of them are of the there, but by the grace of God.
There was a bit of snark in there.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, but I have to say, you know, even if I've disagreed with people, when Craig Kelly was first elected in the early days, I had no particular use for him. But by the time he was leaving, I actually had high praise for Craig Kelly.
Very similar. I mean, when I first got involved and in started understanding who these people were, I thought Craig Kelly was insane. I hear him talk, he's the no guy, no.
Yeah.
And then over the course of time, I think I paid more attention. He's actually became a friend. I think he's one of the few counselors that I genuinely thoroughly enjoy as a human being. I'm really starting to see him go.
Yeah, I found him to be a real straight shooter. And
he became a moderate. I was like, yeah.
A moderate. And actually, when there were various sort of tough negotiations over various matters over the last 5-6 years, I've heard people say, you know, he's actually pretty good to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, he says what he wants, and, you know, he was very clear, and he didn't waffle, you know, and as long as you sort of could meet him halfway, you know, you could count on him, and well, I think that was pretty good.
I think I'd have to say the same thing about JDevs. I definitely started off on the opposition, and, like, even some of the things that she had done as a counselor, like, we never really saw eye to eye on a lot of different things, but Jan Devereaux always read everything you gave her.
That's true.
Jan Devereaux always responded back coherently, intelligently, and she cared. I will go to my grave fighting her on moratoriums on tree cutting.
Right.
Get off my lawn, JDevs. but, you know, we were lucky to have her.
No, I absolutely agree. I thought she was classy from beginning to end, even when I disagreed with her. And
90% of the time.
Right. Well, I mean, but the thing is, she's also she was there for 4 years, and she came in sort of as part of this wave of the sort of the revolutionaries. She mm-hmm. wasn't such a revolutionary, really, but,
you know. Like a moderate now.
Right. So in other words, if it's gung-ho for climate change, mm-hmm. addressing climate change, then we're going to go for it, even if it has other downsides. I didn't always agree with her on some of the bike infrastructure mm-hmm. matters. I agreed with some of it. But, you know, I'm not sort of a monolithic thinker when it comes to how to design streets.
I think the dynamic, though, that was kind of off-putting a little bit to me is like with bikes, like with trees, it's put into the context of an emergency. We got to do it right now, immediately, and it has to be these drastic measures in some cases that don't really do much. Like the moratorium specifically was really only on private owners, didn't really touch public property. And if you look at the people who are actually ripping up and tearing down the most trees, it's bigger public projects. And you're like, well, why can't I cut down my tree, James? What the heck's going on? Right. Or like leaf, or even leaf blowers, or whatever it was.
Just, oh, yeah, you know, yeah.
But like,
I mean, this often is a presumption that you're, if allowed to do what you feel like doing, you're going to only do bad things, you know, as opposed to those of us who says, look, I just want to deal with a tree that's leaning on my roof. Can you cut me some slack here?
And she would say, there is absolutely a process that you can go through.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, well, I don't really want to go through a process. I have an axe in my garage right now.
Exactly. No, and, you know, and it does, there are cost implications to some of these things as well, you know, so.
It's the time. If you've ever done anything with the city, and I love you all very much, but like, god damn, it takes forever.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Now, so that was one. Now, one of the big action items of last night's meeting, and sort of long in coming, was settling the matter of a Cambridge Side Galleria, or are we only supposed to say
the jewel of East Cambridge?
Like it's a mall that could do a bit better. you know, and there were people speaking up in very loud opposition. Yeah. Ultimately, there are people who I thought might be opposed with signing on because of some of the benefits that were going to accrue.
I had no idea. I had no idea how numerous the pro-mall group was. There's just a lot of people who love malls, want to preserve them for all time, want to go back to 1985 and go shopping, hard retail. Amazing to say.
I read something today, and again, I don't know, because I you know, all I knew, all I ever knew, the only opinion I allowed myself on that matter was the fact that for as long as I can remember, ever since warehouse liquors went away, you know, and the
that's the only retail shopping you do,
and Leechmere sales when it used to be a pit down there, is that I never really liked the look and feel of First Street.
Right.
You know, it was this wall of a mall on one side and kind of busted down, not particularly successful. Until Toscanini showed up.
Woo!
On the other side of the street, yeah, right?
Yeah. But, you know, First Street, they had that broken down, busted building that was the mattress or futon place. The mall itself, like all malls, when it was built, controversial.
Very glitzy, yeah.
And when, you know, affecting the retail here, and half the reason why we've made some of the retail decisions we've made was because we were afraid of malls stealing retail off the main streets.
Actually, now turning a lot of formerly occupied properties in Cambridge into parking lots was done in response to Shoppers World, Framingham, back in the 50s, 60s, when there was all these suburban shopping malls. There was a concern that people just drive to those, so we better make sure there's parking here so people can
shop. What I think was lost in the shuffle, though, is like malls, when I was a kid in the 80s, for folks back home, that was a time where they used Casio keyboards a lot.
I was a fully grown adult then.
They, you know, as a kid, we'd go to the mall to like hang out and like meet chicks maybe, or like get an Orange Julius. Now it is just gross.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
No, I
remember the last time I was in a mall.
You know, when I go into most malls, all I see is empty space.
Yeah.
You know, like super high ceilings, lots of fancy stuff. But I said, you know, but where is the action? But that, you know, I kind of feel the same way about a lot of retail. You know, for me, when I was a kid, you go in a Five and Dime store, it was like the aisles were relatively narrow, and they were like multi-decks of stuff where you put toys and stuff and whatever. Stationery supplies all sort of packed in there. If you went into a clothing store, it's like, you know, there was some guy named Saul who would say, "Hey, I got a good pair of pants. You want a
Saul Tenenbaum?"
No, it's a different guy. You know, and he'd reach down underneath in some secret space and pull it out from a pile of stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? That's to me what shopping was supposed to be. Remember, Matt? This is before your time, kid. But when we used to have the Army Navy store across the street over where
call Army Navy stores.
Yeah, yeah. Back when we can you say Army Navy store now, or is that somehow?
We haven't gone that far. But
right, okay.
I lived in a group in Marblehead, and there's a Jerry's Army and Navy in Salem. We go to, it was the only place at the time you could buy Chuck Taylors. True story.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what the cool kids wore.
Right. So now I haven't followed the whole Galleria business very much, but I think they're trying to turn some of the retail outward so that it's not just a blank wall. Oh boy, would that be great,
yeah.
Right? And then, yeah, will some of the interior mall-type feels, so you become more office and whatever? I think that's part of the plan.
So a lot of what developers are looking at in terms of mall spaces now is malls have amazing commercial infrastructures, much more so than office building or larger residential. So they're a great skeleton to work off of. And considering where retail has gone, as you know, it's getting more service-orientated. People are turning them into, either they're adding housing to them, they're adding office, they're everywhere, adding bodies and active uses, because, again, as you've learned in 18 million studies that the city has conducted on retail, you know, people who live in the thing, use the thing, will use the uses down below. About 30 to 40% of those people will utilize those spaces. And when you're considering how retail has been so, I think, complicated and sort of run down because of, I mean, obviously Amazon and other methods of shopping, you have to sort of put the people on top of the retail to make it work.
Right, right. But again, you know, it won't be a success in my eyes if the retail ends up being just she, you know, retail as opposed to, you know, stuff for the rest. Where's the stuff for the
unless
rest?
Unless they bring back Orange Julius, I don't give a damn.
Yeah.
But I hear you on that. But it'll be
how much room do you need to set up an Orange Julius stand? Much?
I think you need like a blender, an outlet, and a cash.
Okay, so here's my plan. Okay,
100 square feet.
You want to open up a cannabis retail outlet in Cambridge, Massachusetts? Okay, you work with your property owner, and here's the plan you present to the planning board. You say, I'm going to take this front window here, mm-hmm, and rather than have it be glass, you know, clouded over.
What about art, Robert? Just art.
I love art, but I don't want it in my retail windows. Gotcha. I want a frontage. So propose an Orange Julius stand right there in the front. So you see, here's a guy that makes keys, and here's a guy you buy an Orange Julius.
It seems like a natural marriage between grass and Orange Julius.
This person sells little model cars to little kids coming by, and then the entrance to the cannabis place, right?
I'm not so sure the model cars with the kids.
Okay, but yeah, swap I get with the Orange Julius, right? Okay.
Or a pretzel or a cookie or a bag of Doritos.
This is all negotiable.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course,
right?
Of course.
Right. But, you know, honestly, I want retail to be sort of active. You know, retail, teeny little niche retail, I think
so
I would be great.
What's the deal? Are they going to preserve the jewel of East Cambridge, or is the evil? Did the evil developer win?
All right, so what happened was is that after some contention, and I think an attempt to try and torpedo at the end, but in the end, it passed. It needed 6 votes to pass. It passed on a 6-3 vote with councillors Devereaux, Carlone, and Zondervan voting no. But at least Carlone, you know, who, by the way, was the author of a lot of the previous plan that actually set up the Galleria back in his previous life. I think he kind of said, like, I know this is going to be a 6-3 vote. My vote isn't going to turn it one way or the other. So I'm going to vote no. Some of the no votes were sending a little bit of message to.
But the message has been received ad nauseum. You could have predicted that vote. No matter, I mean, you could have predicted that vote last year.
I agree. I think there is a valid issue, and some of the councilors did at least speak to it. I don't know if they're going to do anything differently, really, honestly, because, you know, hey, we love the goodies, right?
So, but like, what if, just for one second, we say that is not a bad way to do business, and that the alternative is we rezone the city to allow for some of the things to be by right, and then the developer goes in, and when you talk about, oh, where's my community developments package, he says, oh, yeah, this is by right. No.
Right. Yeah.
I don't necessarily. I have mixed emotions about that. But I think the outcome for this mall and what was New England Development and Rich McKinnon and his team have produced is an absolute no brainer. And for us to even had hemmed and hawed or vacillated, like, oh, you know, what are we doing? I have some friends in West Cambridge who are very concerned. It's kind of nonsense.
I'm inclined to agree. But I think the procedure, an ideal procedure, would be that when the ordinance committee is arguing these things out, they should make a list that says, look, these are our planning objectives. Mm-hmm. Have we met them? Let's go through the list. Does it meet this criteria? Does it meet this here? You know, like that. And they say, okay, now that we've settled on that, so from a planning point of view, this is a good thing.
Right.
Now let's talk about all the other stuff. And at least get those priorities clear.
Absolutely. I think a lot of these developers and development teams, if you read the materials they produce, they spend way more time studying our studies than we do.
You mean they actually understand this stuff?
They understand it.
Actually, that's been my experience
as
well.
And they follow it almost instinctively. Like, I remember when the lighting ordinance was going about, even though that never really passed, a lot of us were talking about how we're going to comply with it. Even talking to design groups in Boston who knew about this change, like they were designing as if it were a given certainty that it would pass.
Right.
So people are all like, we don't just plan in a bubble. Everyone's watching.
Listen, if you got serious money, you want to invest in something, you don't walk in blind.
No.
You read. You understand. You calculate the risks. You calculate the potential benefits. Mm-hmm. You understand what is going to be stable in terms of a zoning climate,
yeah.
Right? And more, my experience is that the people who are actually going to put their cash on the barrel to make something happen do study this more than pretty much every political person and probably more than every staff person within the development department, you know? And that's not meant as a slight. I'm just saying is that, you know, when it's your money, you know, and your plans and your pride,
right?
You pay attention.
I think the notion is not that to slight staff or anyone else, but I think that the notion that developers aren't paying attention and that we aren't trying to follow the guidelines that the city lays down is not a true thing. So while right. you may not like the outcome, and oftentimes people don't necessarily not like the building itself, they hate the finishes of the building.
Right.
Like you look at Mass and Main, you're like, you could have put 10 more stories in that, I wouldn't notice. However, they plastered linoleum looking brick all over it. It looks terrible.
Well, the thing about one thing, you know, since you mentioned Mass and Main, let's not forget that when the K2 C2 process was happening, of which you were a member of the C2 process, even before it became, well, it never was made into zoning until people like yourself actually took parts of it to actually incorporate mm-hmm. into zoning. But the fact that seemed to be coming mm-hmm. was coincided with when Normandy Twining actually purchased the properties and started to plan ahead. So they were reading it. They were very aware could be coming.
They said they came to a bunch of meetings, but I'm not so sure I saw them. But they were definitely aware. And they even said,
yeah.
We would have built the C2 if you had passed it.
Exactly. So, you know, so there ain't no idle talk when you talk about, you know, big plans like this. They're paying attention yeah. and they are going to find a way to respond. So anyway, we're winding down on this half hour, but we'll be back for another exciting half hour. We'll talk maybe about some Harvard Square. And I'd like to learn a little bit about form-based zoning.
You got it.
All right. See you then.